Blog Talk Radio.
So much media, so little time. Who keeps track of it all? That would be me. This is Bob Andelman, and this is the Mr. Media Interview, broadcast and recorded live on blogtalkradio.com from the new media and American League Baseball, capital of the world, St. Petersburg, Florida. I am not the world's biggest Harry Potter fan, and I'll tell you that right up front. The only book in the series that I've read is the first, which my wife and I took turns reading aloud to my daughter when she was just learning to read herself. Since then, they've consumed each and every book in the series and reread the books and rewatched the movies over and over. So I wasn't so sure how interested I'd be when I received the graphic novel version of Jim Butcher's The Dresden Files. More magic? Oy. But let me tell you, if you haven't read it, this is one very cool series. I love the notion of a wizard operating within the almost real world of Chicago, working at arm's length from both the police and organized crime. If Harry Potter continued into adulthood and into the real world of modern London, I'd probably give those books another look. The Dresden Files began and continues as a series of novels, of course. It was also briefly a syndicated television series. If you need a jumping on point, try the graphic novel, as I did. It's Stormfront. That's actually, I think it's sort of the, I'm going to ask you about this. I think it's the second one out, but anyway, we'll talk about that. The book, the graphic novel, which is a comic book, for those of you who don't speak the lingo, it's adapted by Mark Powers and drawn by Ardian Sayaf. And then follow me backward into reading the books. So, Jim, welcome to Mr. Media.
Oh, thank you very much.
Glad to have you here. I very much enjoyed the book.
Oh, thank you. That was kind of the idea.
I suspected that. Although I have had people send me books just to torture me. Maybe not, they didn't come out and say it, but there has been torture involved. I understand that Rumsfeld and Cheney have been behind it, so I know it was indeed torture. So congratulations for making an old man believe in stories of magic.
Oh well, thank you. I've always thought that the ghost story, the fairy tale, the supernatural story, has never really left us. We just haven't really updated it for a while. We sort of skipped it. We went from elves to little green men for 50 or 60 years there, and I think this is just kind of a resurgence of fairy tales.
I like that. I like that description. And that was the thing. I pretty much, as I said in the introduction, after I finished reading it, I was like, you know, my jaw was kind of like, wow, that was, you know, it dropped a bit. That was kind of cool. I said to my wife, forget the Harry Potter. You need to sit down and read this. This is, you know.
I think
this
my favorite description that I've ever heard of the books that I've read that somebody else has written for them was Dirty Harry Potter. And I was down with that. I like that.
I like that a lot. Yeah. Well, I want to give out our phone number because I have a feeling you'll have a fan or two who may want to call in and talk to you. If you've got a question or comment for Jim Butcher, the author of the Dresden Files series, give us a call, 646-595-3135, and we'll get your calls on just as quick as we can. So, Jim, how did the whole Dresden world start? What were you doing professionally when the inspiration for this struck?
Well, at the time I was in graduate school, I was working a number of part-time jobs. I was in graduate school for professional writing, and I'd been ignoring some very good advice from my writing teacher for several semesters because, you know, I had an English Lit degree, and she merely had published 40 novels. So, you know, I knew which of us knew what was going on. And finally, one semester, I decided, you know what, I am just going to, this semester, just to prove how wrong she is, I'm just going to do everything she tells me to. I'm going to be her good little writing zombie. I'm going to follow all the little rules and do all the little worksheets, and she'll just see what terrible, awful, pablum, cookie-cutter crap comes out. And I wrote the first book of the Dresden Files as a class project.
Oh, boy. It kind of paid for your tuition, I guess.
That's kind of behind me. Actually, the actual fact is that they booted me from the School of Professional Writing.
really?
I guess I didn't have what it takes to be a professional writer. I don't know.
It's so sad for you.
Yeah, you can tell I'm broken up about it these days.
Yeah, well, let's give credit where credit is due. Where was that?
That was that. Your computer keeps talking to me sort of randomly. That
Sorry.
Was at the University of Oklahoma's Journalism Department, the School of Professional Writing there. It's still being run, as far as I know, by Deborah Chesters, a science fiction author. She's an excellent teacher. It's an excellent program. I didn't get along so well with the other aspects of their journalism school, but that's neither here nor there.
Well, and I mean, there are aspects of journalism that are very much science fiction. So, you know, I can see how you would do that. So you've always wanted to write.
Yeah, since I was about 18, I remember one day, this will tell you about the kind of person I am. My senior year of high school, I was cool enough to be skipping class, but when I was skipping class, I went to the library and was in there reading. And Margaret Weiss, who writes a series of books called the Dragonlance novels, came in and to give a talk to people, and I just happened to be there, and I listened to her and said, "Hey, that could be cool, writing." And I wrote my first book the next summer.
Wow, so it's all worked out. Now, how long before you're actually able to make a living at it?
Well, let's see. I wrote my first book in the summer of 1991. I got my first paycheck in early 2000. So about 9 years before
wow.
Before I got any money, and then it was before it was actually supporting us. It was 2005.
Wow. Okay. So that's some serious dues paying time.
Yeah. Well, I might have done it faster if I was a little less dumb. But you know, I kept thinking I knew what I was talking about all the way along. So it sort of slowed me down.
And how were you paying the bills up until then?
Oh, I worked a bunch of jobs all through college, and I did a lot of technical support type stuff. I'd be the guy that would work, they would have me work from like 10 p.m. to 6 a.m. I'd be the guy at the internet provider where, you know, somebody would call me at 2 in the morning. They'd broken their computer at 5. They'd irretrievably screwed it up by 8. But they hadn't called for help until 2. And then I had to be the guy to deal with that person. And stuff like that. And then of course, my wife, after she got her engineering degree, you know, when you get an English degree, they're like, "Would you like a paper hat?" But when you get an engineering degree, you know, they're like, "Here, we want to pay you real money."
I was one of those people, just so you know, that would, you know, the computer would you would struggle with it for hours and hours, and finally give up and say, "Oh, the hell with it! I'm calling support at, you know, 1 or 2 o'clock in the morning." But
right.
You had to put in the hours of thinking, "I can do this," and then of course you wind up making the situation far worse than it ever should have been.
Oh, yeah, it can happen. It can happen.
Now, I think I read on your site that Dresden was actually your second series, right? Or you wrote some other books.
Oh, well, yeah, I mean, when I started writing, I mean, the first book I wrote was this, you know, this kind of epic swords and horses fantasy novel, you know, very Lord of the Ringsy, and
okay.
It was just awful. So I wrote another one, and then that was terrible, and then I wrote a sequel to the first one and a sequel to the second one. They were both awful. And then I wrote this kind of takeoff on that was kind of an X-Files inspired thing, you know, sort of modern paranormal stuff. That too was terrible because I was just not listening to a lot of really good advice. So after I'd written 5 really terrible novels, which I don't even have a copy of them sitting around somewhere. I mean, I would not inflict them on Osama bin Laden. You know, they're just that bad. And finally, you know, I finally started listening, and I wrote the first book, The Dresden Files. And then I said, well, you know, maybe if some of the principles she was talking about worked there, maybe I could try them with the next one. And then the next project I started was called The Codex Alera, which is the series that I've got in print, the fantasy series I've got running now.
Okay. Well, so the original books, they were written, but they were never published then?
Well, those first 5? Oh, yeah. Oh, God, no. You couldn't have gotten an editor to read past page 5 or 6 of those books.
Okay.
I mean, they were just that bad. They were full of the things that would make an editor go, "This person is not ready to work as a professional writer."
That's sad. And how did you? I mean, were you married at any of this at this point?
Oh yeah. I was married when I wrote my first novel, and you know, my wife was there supporting me the whole time. More so after she had gotten the job and was actually, you know, pulling in the income for the family. Up until then, there was a lot of scrambling around the first five years or so. But we made it through. It was kind of tough. And now she's writing novels too. So it worked out.
I saw that. Shannon Butcher.
Yes. Yeah. She's writing romance novels. And now she's just gotten her first supernatural romance published. And I honestly think, you know, maybe 5-6 years from now, she's going to be the famous one. People are going to be like, oh, who's that with Shannon? That's her husband. I think he writes some kind of fantasy thing.
Well, I wanted to ask you about that because, you know, so she was literally supporting you through, you know, a lot of these early rough times. So maybe she was just, you know, I was going to ask you if you know, if it was hard, if she pushed you to maybe give it up at any point. Or if, and then now that it's worked out, and now that she's writing too, if it was a matter of she was just kind of letting all you let you deal with all the bad stuff, so you know when she was ready to make her move, it would all be easy.
Oh no, no. She has been totally supportive of the entire thing. Although I got to admit that for probably going on year 7 or 8 when I hadn't actually gotten anything published or made any money, you know, getting back to the family gatherings at holidays and hearing, so when are you going to get a real job? We're starting to get kind of old. And but of course now I can, you know, if I can face some of those people again, I could say, I've just decided not to get a real job. I'm just going to keep writing books.
It is nice to let them know that it did finally work out.
Yeah. Yeah, it was very satisfying. It's one of those things that to kind of have somebody else's faith in you and your belief in yourself vindicated after that long. Granted, it might not have been that long if I wasn't quite so dumb, but after that long, that's really that gives you a foundation for other things to build on. You know, that you just can't find anywhere else. You know, to be able to come through that and come out on top.
Has anyone actually said to you, you know, Jim, I never really thought you were going to make it, so I have to admit I'm impressed that you did.
No, everybody has said, I knew you'd make it from the get-go. No, nobody else really has really come out and said that. Although my writing teacher, when she found out that I had been, the school was disinclined to let me continue my studies, she was just like, I swear, on the first copy, the first book I get, I'm going to have it on the back of the book, I'm going to say, cast out of the University of Oklahoma's writing program. And my writer, she says, oh, please don't do that. I've worked really hard to get this program some respect, and I know you're going to make it because you've got the talent for it. You know, it's just a matter of time. So you don't have to say great things about us, but please don't pan us. I'm like, well, okay.
Have you given any thought, or maybe have you killed off anyone from the program in one of the books?
Oh, no, nothing like that. Although there was kind of an ex-girlfriend that sort of died in effigy in at the beginning of Full Moon, but other than that,
interesting. Did she die a horrible miserable death?
Yes, and I felt bad for it later. But you know, but what can you do? I mean, you know, it's already been written and there's books on the shelves now and. I can't go back in, you know, painting cell phones in instead of guns in people's hands. So,
well, you know, I've mentioned this to people before. I write nonfiction books. I do a lot of work with people telling their story for business and stuff, and hope eventually to slide over to fiction. And I've often said one of the things I'm going to do is get even with an awful lot of people in those first couple of books. you know, I will not lie. That is exactly what I will do.
What was it? It was kind of a terrible movie, but it had a really great line in it. A Knight's Tale, the one that starred Keith Ledger. But one of the characters in it was Geoffrey Chaucer, and he was actually talking to a clergyman and you know some of the characters that wound up being in his writing. You know, he did. What are you going to do to us? I will eviscerate you in fiction. You will be remembered forever as these horrible people. And I love that phrase, eviscerated in fiction.
I like that. I think, well, I mean, you did it once. I guess, you know, you probably got it out of your system.
Yeah, well, and it was literal, too. I mean, I think there was actual evisceration involved, but...
God, I like that. Now, was that in the? So that was in one of the Dresden books.
Yeah, it was in the second Dresden book.
Okay.
I mean, that was also one that I had not published the first one. There was nobody. There didn't seem anybody was terribly interested in it. I started writing the second one because it was fun, and said, "Why not? This is going to be the gory and painful one. Why not excise some bad, you know, some bad vibes from the past?"
And did the girl ever get wind of this?
Don't think so.
Well, then.
I don't know, though. I mean, I haven't seen her in years, so who knows?
Well, let's talk about the books, and I want to repeat the phone number. We've got some people in who are listening and are in the live web chat that goes along with the live Mr. Media interviews. If you want to give us a call and talk to Jim Butcher, 1-646-595-3135. Those of you who've been reading the books longer than I have probably have much better questions, so I will definitely yield the floor to you. Feel free to give us a call. And now that I said that, I see there's somebody on the line. Here, let's go to the calls. Hi, do you have a comment or question for Jim Butcher?
Hi, yeah. I just want to say I've actually gotten a lot of my friends reading in on the novels and giving away the first one as a gift to a few people who've then turned around and bought the rest of the series. But I just wondered, is there like a ending planned on it, or are you just going to keep kind of writing them?
I'm going to write about 20 of the case books like we've seen so far. I'll say that 20-ish, because it could be 19, it could be 21, depending on whether or not my kid goes to grad school. I could lie to you, but I won't. I'll write about 20-ish of the case books we've had so far, and then I'm going to close the whole thing off with a big old apocalyptic trilogy, because, you know, who doesn't love apocalyptic trilogies?
I don't know. Sure.
there was a plan, you know, for the story, the overall story from the very beginning, and we're pretty much on track with it. I'm happy with how it's gone.
Cool, thanks.
Yeah, no problem.
Hey, before you hang up, can I ask you, how many of the books have you read?
I've read them all. I've been working on tracking down the short stories, and read the Stormfront comic.
Yeah, I'm gonna actually put all the short stories together in a collection that is going to come out next year. Let me see. I know I've got to finish the book I'm working on now by the end of July, and then the next Dresden Files book has to be done by Christmas, and then the short story collection has got to be done by February, so it'll probably be out sometime later in the summer. But I'm going to get all the short stories in one book and put them out so that, you know, everybody can get to them instead of having to track them down in 15 different anthologies.
Yeah. Awesome. That'll be good to pick up then.
Yeah, I hope so.
Let me ask you... Wait, before you hang up, one more question. What appeals to you about the Dresden Files? What is it? And, you know, I mentioned, I don't know if you heard the introduction, but I mentioned that I'm not a particular Harry Potter fan, but I like this because it's some of the same kind of elements, but it's an adult setting. It's almost a real-world setting. But what appeals to you about it?
Well, I really like the detective aspect of it, and I think that the magic really spices it up. And I just really like Dresden as a character. It's interesting to read about and see his take on things. I think it's a really fun and funny series.
Great. Well, I very much appreciate the call, and appreciate you hanging in there for my own questions for you.
Sure, no problem.
All right, thanks for calling.
Bye.
All right, bye-bye. Well, that was cool. What I wanted to ask you was, how has Harry Dresden, who, for people who haven't read it yet, it's the Dresden Files. Harry Dresden is the star of the stories. How has he evolved since the first book? And, you know, how do you think of him any differently than you did when you started? I mean, has it evolved, or was he fully formed from day one?
Yeah, he just kind of jumped out of my head, and there he was. As far as how he's changed since then, I think he's been working on the, you know, one of the famous quotes about wizards is from The Lord of the Rings, where somebody's warned, be careful, do not trifle with wizards, for they are subtle and quick to anger. And Dresden's response to that when somebody said it to him was, I'm not so subtle. and he's sort of been kind of working on increasing that sort of subtlety as he's gotten older. He's a little bit less likely to kick down the door shooting these days, mostly because that's too much like a fair fight, and he's coming to the conclusion that if you've gotten into a fair fight, somebody's done something wrong. But as he's gotten older, he's kind of getting a longer range point of view on things, trying to get a broader idea about what the consequences of his actions are going to be, because that's what, you know, all these things keep happening. And a lot of times he can make a short-sighted decision and the consequences last for years, you know, they come back to him. It's one of those series where, even though I'm trying to keep each story separate, I don't want it to be to have like an episodic feel, like you could watch him in any order you wanted. I want this character to be somebody who you can see developing and growing. He gets hurt, you know, he picks up his scars, and he finds ways to go on. But I think at the core, though, he's still the same character. He's still the guy who is, he's just the guy that when there's somebody in trouble, he needs to help them, and it's just this pathology he's got going. So when folks run into problems, when there's absolutely no one else they can turn to, you know, they'll show up at his door, and he'll be like, okay, I'll help. I've got to be insane, but I'll help.
Right. I tell you what he reminded me of, and it was only in rereading it again today to get ready for talking to you that I thought of this, and I don't know if anyone listening will agree with me or not. I actually found that I got to thinking that if Will Eisner was still operating today and he was creating the spirit today, we might see him be somewhat similar to Terry Dresden. I mean, and you see that I see the parallels anyway, the way he is with women, the fact that he always gets the snot beat out of him. You know, I mean, you know, so you that's know, just me. I don't know if anyone would agree.
I think I would argue for some classic Peter Parker influence to go with it. You know, I mean, actually, in some of the books I actually have, somebody asked Dresden why he's doing something self-destructive, but necessary to the helping of some other person. It's like, why are you doing this? And Harry answers him, obviously, I'm a disciple of the Tao of Peter Parker. you know, Spider-Man was hands down my favorite hero when I was reading, or you know, when I was a kid, when I was growing up, I started picking up comic books when I was about 11, and just went nuts on them for 5 or 6 years. Peter Parker was hands down my favorite hero of the entire set.
Mm. Well, and I want to ask you in a little bit about the comics, the graphic novels. Yeah, that's good to know. I suspected that you had to have some connection to that. And first of all, to even, you know, go the route of having them adapted this way. But
oh, are you kidding? I get a comic book. I get to see these things that were only in my head. Yes, I want to do that.
Yeah, well, but that's because you were a reader of comics. There are more than a few guys, I suspect, who write fiction and would be offended if somebody thought that their stuff should be adapted to comics. So,
they need to have some decaf. It's life's too short. You have to enjoy things where you find them. I tell you, in my head, it kind of plays as an animated series in my head when I'm writing it anyway. So actually having it in comics is really neat, something I've always liked the idea of.
Well, now you mentioned the reference to Peter Parker. I want to ask you about, I'm looking at the page in the graphic novel where we encounter Morgan with his sword out, and he calls out, Harry Blackstone Copperfield Dresden. Okay, tell me why you chose to give him the names of Harry Blackstone and David Copperfield.
It's Harry Houdini, Harry Blackstone and David
Harry Houdini. Well, I'm sorry, Harry being his first name. I wasn't even thinking.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah, his Harry Dresden's dad, which you find out in the series, I'm not sure it's right there in the books anywhere, but his dad was a traveling magician. He was a professional performing magician, not a wizard. That was his mm-hmm. mom. Harry's mom died when he was very, very young, as part of the labor, I think. His father was the one who cared for him. And Harry's dad died when he was about six, but Harry's memories of his father are traveling around, his dad doing, you know, these little magician shows for birthday parties and grocery store openings and stuff like that, and being on the road with him. Harry's dad named him without his mom there to help. So he chose the names of some of his, you know, some of his personal inspirations for his son. So Harry Houdini, Harry Blackstone, and Copperfield, whom Harry's dad was knew when he was getting going in his career. You know,
okay.
Of course, Copperfield winds up one of the greatest performers in the world, and you know, one of the most wealthy performers in the world, and Harry's dad is driving a station wagon around back, you know, around rural United States. But
right. And how now? From where I've read so far, and you know, which is the graphic novel this, of Stormfront. What it left me wondering is where will I need to read in the novels to find out about how he became, you know, a real, you know, caster of spells, a real magician, a wizard.
Let me think.
Where is that explained?
His backstory is kind of parceled out over several books.
Okay.
And there's lots of it that he doesn't know himself. Especially with regards to who his mom was and what her role was in the, you know, in the world, the supernatural world at large.
Like
but
Wolverine.
Basically, it's something that when you've got in the stories, when you've got a serious talent for magic, it sort of manifests about puberty because I read way too much X-Men when I was a kid. And that's when you start developing a talent. And at this point, he didn't have any parents. He was in the foster care system. He was adopted by his teacher, whose name was Justin DuMorin. And DuMorin was the one who was his mentor, was the one who taught him magic and so on, and who later tried to kill him, and it didn't go well for that.
Well, as all good mentors eventually do.
Well, of course, because I watched Star Wars too often when I was a kid. And
I like that. So, you know, where is Harry's place in the world now? I mean, he seems like he's kind of two worlds, not sure that he fits in either place.
Oh, no, he doesn't at all. There is an entire political structure in the supernatural world that exists within the regular world. Not so much that they keep it a secret from people as that people are just too dumb to want to pay attention to it, and so they talk themselves out of it. But there are various supernatural nations that are involved. One of them is the White Council of Wizards, and they see themselves as the guardians, the protectors of humanity at large. And there's been Harry managed to start a war between the wizards and the vampire courts. There's several different flavors of vampire, and they each have their own little court within the world. And so there was a war going on for a long time, and so many of the foot soldiers, the policemen of the White Council, who are a group of men called the Wardens, who Morgan represents, mm-hmm. but so many of them were killed in the war that eventually they drafted Dresden. They showed up with a gray cloak and said, "Here, put it on. You're a warden now." And you know, they kind of made him an offer he couldn't refuse. And so Harry wound up being a warden, and now he's got all the young wizards in the council think he's just great. Because he's defied the senior council so often, and all the older conservative wizards think he's a time bomb just waiting to go off, and they're all just waiting for their chance to kill him. And meanwhile, I mean, really, all he really wants to do is to, you know, be able to get his bills paid, be able to live a quiet life, but it just doesn't work out that way for him.
Mm. Now, where I am in the story, he's got the doom of Damocles hanging over him, which sounds to me a lot like in Animal House, the double secret probation.
Yes. I like that.
Yeah.
The Doom of Damocles is Harry violated one of the laws of magic. There's seven laws of magic, and one of them is thou shalt not kill. You can't use magic to kill. And Harry, actually, he squared off against his mentor in a duel when he was 16 and came out on top. He won and killed his mentor. And the council found that by, you know, even though the sentence for breaking the law was death, and they carried out without any compunctions at all, there was somebody who stood up for him and who said, "Hey, it was self-defense. I think that, you know, we should give him a chance to show that he's, you know, that he's not going to turn into some hideous monster now." And the council said, "All right, then we'll put him under the Doom of Damocles." And basically what it is you get to walk around with a warden just sort of following you around, keeping an eye on you. And if he sees you step out of line, he kills you. And that's that. You know,
that's fair.
Yeah, I mean, you know, that's fair. If you make a mistake, we kill you. As opposed to killing you right now, we wait for a good excuse.
Mm-hmm.
So that's kind of why, Morgan's been shadowing Harry around, you know, kind of his own personal... you know, kind of his own personal Marley, only a little bit more proactive.
Well, it seems reasonable that, you know, you're not allowed to kill with magic, but I am glad that you can kill with by writing books about magic. So that's good. You know. So obviously it pleases you that there's a comic series, a graphic novel series, based on the Dresden Files. But you're not writing it. Mark Powers is adapting the stories. Do you have any regrets about not doing it yourself?
Oh, no regrets in that. I wrote the introduction. There was a novel called, a graphic novel called Welcome to the Jungle, which was kind of the standard four-issue graphic novel-sized four-issue story that it actually takes place, I wrote as a prequel to the events of Stormfront. And I wrote it myself. And what I came to the conclusion that writing graphic novels is hard. I figured, hey, I'm a writer, I know what I'm doing, and so on. And then I find that this is not a novel. I'm entering an entirely different arena of endeavor here. And that while, you know, some of my skills do transfer over, a lot of them don't. There's such a different focus in terms of writing a novel, in terms of how you tell your story versus writing a graphic novel. And while I'm not writing it, they are sending the scripts to me for approval, so I can look over them and go, hey, I don't want you to do this, or maybe we could change that around. Although the only things I've really come up with in terms of criticism is, you know, aren't you writing this a little bit too faithfully to the book? You know, couldn't we just kind of elide over this part, which is not going to really play in as much? I mean, this is just kind of a lot of talking head conversation. We should get past this to the special effects. and they ignore me or don't ignore me. You know, but they know their job better than I. But, you know, they know their job better than I do. Which the great thing about my experience with learning how to write novels and learning to listen to other people is that. I'm very willing to admit to myself that I can be dumb. So, you know, about this, I am dumb where they are smart in some ways, and so I'm trying to take their advice.
Is
you know,
there
the folks
a,
who actually
a
do it for a living? Yeah, goodness, they might know more about it than me.
Is there a formula of adapting the novels to the comics format? You know, each novel will be assign so many pages in the comics format, or how does that work exactly?
I think they said it was going to be either 12 or 16 issues for a novel.
Okay.
They said it was going to be somewhere between 12 and 16. They weren't sure exactly how much it would be, but they would have to see. Although so far, I think they've done pretty well. I think they've gotten about they might be doing it faster than that. They might have covered about a third of the novel in this first graphic novel. But then again, the special effects budget gets a lot higher in the second half of the book. So maybe they're saving the page space for that. So you can have, you know, that's one of the things, the page spaces in comic books is so critically important. It's one of those things they had to make me understand. It's like, Jim, you're putting six panels on this page and two paragraphs of conversation in each panel. There's actually not going to be any room for anybody to actually appear.
Yeah.
Oh, right. Okay. I'll have to fix this then.
I was always amazed to, you know, listen to how the, you know, in the 60s, the Marvel comics were formed, you know, that Stan would say, okay, here's the general idea. And he turned it over to the artist and the artist would plot out the pages and then, you know, kind of figure how to – it always amazed me that they could, you know, whatever number, 22 pages within a 32-page book, whatever it was, and it would, the artist would plot it out without knowing what the words were going to be, and then Stan would come in and write it all in, and I just thought, wow.
Yeah,
I mean,
that's unbelievable.
They don't get a lot of respect in that field compared to, you know, other creative endeavors, but it always has been I've always been in awe of their ability to do that. And then you get to the end of 22 pages, the 22-page story, and you go, that was cool.
Yeah, exactly. And as far as respect goes, boy, you're speaking for others because I got to meet Stan Lee. That's the coolest thing about this entire comic book thing. I actually got to meet Stan Lee at Comic-Con in New York a couple years ago, and I could barely make myself talk to him. My editor had to grab me by the elbow and drag me over and introduce me.
I know what you're saying. I have not met him in person. I did interview him twice for. I did the biography of Will Eisner, who I mentioned before, and
right.
got to talk to Stan and have communicated since then with Stan. And actually, he's been kind enough to my daughter over the last couple of years has had an email conversation with him several times about stuff. And you know, he's just a wonderful guy.
He is.
So,
he really is.
Yeah, and it is hard to be able to speak to a guy that you just. Can be so in awe of something
oh,
like
I
that.
Oh, I know. I can't go up and talk to him. They're like, come on. No, my editor made me do it finally. Mr. Lee, I'm a big fan.
Yeah. Well, I want to give out a phone number one more time before we start winding down here. If you've been waiting till the end for a chance to talk to Jim, 646-595-3135. Give us a call now while we've got him here live. Speaking of the comics, Ardian Syaf, I hope I'm saying his name right.
I believe so.
Is the artist in the certainly in the book I have in front of me, the Stormfront, the Volume 1, The Gathering Storm. And as good as the story is in Stormfront, I don't think it would be anywhere near as commanding because it is comics without his pencils. I just think they're incredible.
Oh yeah, I've been really impressed with him. And he was the guy that when they were looking for an artist, when they were first putting the idea, the Bells were first putting the idea together, and we need an artist, and do you have an artist you want to use? And I said, I don't really know any comic book artist, but then a friend of mine named Katie Murphy, who I occasionally played City of Heroes with, says, hey, there's this guy in my supergroup. You should see his stuff. He's really good. And I'm like, okay. And so she sent me some of his work. And this was Ardian, apparently, and she sent me some of his work, and I said, well, this looks pretty good to me. I mean, I had no, you know, serious appreciation for who was really good and who wasn't, especially of Lakes. I hadn't picked up a comic book for a couple of years. But I sent him on to the DeBells and said, what do you think? And they said, we think we want to offer him a contract.
Yeah.
And then they started picking, and then he started doing art, and I felt sorry for him because, you know, we had to go through several incarnations of the different characters, and you know, yet faithfully every time he'd write something in, I'd say, no, this is totally wrong. Here, do this that is completely different, and have it do two or three impossible things at the same time, and you know, he'd come back and finally came back with these characters that looked like the ones that were in my brain.
Yeah, I don't want to hurt anyone's feelings here, but at the back of the Stormfront graphic novel, the collection here, is the story Restoration of Faith, and the art is by a different artist. I won't even mention him because I don't want to hurt anyone's feelings, but it is so incredibly different, and once you go from reading these chapters with Ardian's work, and then you hit that, you're like, we even talk about the same world? I just want to be complimentary to Artie, and I don't mean to be
right.
This stuff it's great stuff, especially, you know, because it has to be. You know, if anyone's read Doctor Strange, you know that there has to be the special effects, the look, and the stuff that's going on when magic is happening. It has to have a special look and feel, and
right.
and the characters have to look different than the effect of what's going on around them.
And that's one. I think that's one of the great things. That's one of the things that really marks his talent is that it's not terribly uncommon for any artist to come out with something good once in a while. But Ardian is turning out solid panels, you know, solid pages day after day. You know, I mean, he has such a high standard of workmanship. We've been terribly pleased with him. The DeBells were thrilled when they got him signed on. I've been very happy with all the work he's done. Occasionally I write in and say, you know, I think this character is a little bit taller, a little bit shorter in relation to so-and-so, and I'll have to make some comments along those lines. No, wait, he wears this ring on the middle finger, not the ring finger. And then they're going to fix, it'll get fixed in the next generation. But I've been totally pleased with how he's done expression and how he uses shadow and motion.
Mm. Now tell me, I got to ask you, tell me about Bob. The skull in
Bob
in,
the skull,
Bob the skull in Harry Dresden's basement. First of all, I gotta love the name, why is he named Bob and why is he stuck in the basement?
Okay, Bob the skull is the name of. It started off as an inside joke between me and my writing teacher, because remember, I was just writing this to prove to her how wrong she was.
Right.
So I wrote the character of Bob the Skull. I said, okay, I'm going to have this. I'm going to create this kind of sidekick slash assistant for Harry, because I want somebody around. There's a concept in writing called the joy of idiocy is how I learned it, where you always keep somebody on stage who's kind of a dummy so that they can ask a question, and then you can have the question answered on stage, so then the audience has the information they need to get the rest of the story. So I said, okay, joy of idiocy, normally the idiot's going to be Murphy, who's going to be the one asking questions of Harry about what's going on because he's the wizard. But then when Harry runs into something that he doesn't know what's going on, he needs to have somebody he can turn to ask to talk to, and then Harry can be the idiot for his assistant. So I'm going to give him this magical assistant who can answer questions, but who can't go out and do stuff, who has to stay in the basement. And my teacher's like, all right, that's fine with me, as long as you don't make the character a talking head. And a talking head is writing term for somebody who just shows up, spouts information, and then goes away again. It doesn't really have any personality or anything. You always see these guys like in old pulp fiction movies, pulp science fiction, where they'll say, as you know, Bob, in order to escape the velocity of the Earth, a rocket has to be moving it, you know, and they give you this information, you know, but Bob knew that information, so why are you telling him that? So I decided to create a literal talking head named Bob in the basement, and I remember walking in and showing her that chapter, and she read over that chapter and looked at me and said, you think you're funny, don't you?
I loved it.
It was a lot of fun to write. Bob the Skull is a great character. He's like my inner 14-year-old, you know, hormone-laden teenager, and I have a lot of fun writing him.
Got it. And so the TV series based on Dresden Files has it's come and gone now. What can you say about it now that you couldn't say in 2007 when it was in production?
It could have been worse. which I will actually, I think I was saying that in 2007 as well. It could have been worse. Although now I can say, well, at least they stopped the series before they messed up anything really badly. In terms of making it completely unpalatable. I mean, there were a lot of things a lot of changes that they had to make. I understood some of them. I completely did not understand some others. I've got a theory about why it got canceled. I mean, I've got no proof whatsoever to support it, but I figure I shouldn't let that get in the way of a good conspiracy theory. but looking back on it, I mean, it could have been a lot worse. I've still got some reservations about a few things, but all in all, I've seen. I mean, for God's sake, Dean Koontz's stuff has been treated so much worse on screen than the Dresden Files was. I'm not even going to complain about how that turned out. But still, it was neat to see it happening. It was a cool experience, you know, the rights revert back to me in 2 years and 10 months and change. Not that I'm keeping track.
I was going to ask you, would you like to see it get a second life, either TV or film?
It would be cool. It'd be great. Although I'll be honest with you, what I'd really like to see is a massive multiplayer role playing game.
Yeah, no, I've read that you're very into gaming, and you made reference to City of Heroes a little while ago. And I saw on your site that you actually, you know, you're telling your fans where they can, you know, play games with you. That's
yeah,
how's
exactly.
That working
and
out?
We'll actually go out and go beat up bad guys. I mean, you know, nothing helps you bond with a fan like knocking Nazis off the roof of a skyscraper together.
I guess I don't have that kind of fan, but I'll take your word.
Well, you know, that's how it's worked out for me anyway. So,
when you talk about, and this is to show you that I am so not involved in gaming, are you interacting with them online playing games or
yes.
Actually in person? Yes, online.
Yeah,
right?
Yeah. I'll be playing my City of Heroes character. I mean, I actually play much of the time. I actually play a character named Harry Dresden on City of Heroes. And you can't play copyrighted, they won't let you violate copyright, so you can't play, like, you can't go play Wolverine, you can't go play Superman. But I can go play Harry Dresden because I'm the copyright holder, which is kind of neat. You know, so he's like, people are like, wow, I feel like I met a celebrity, you know, because Harry Dresden came hopping over the, you know, came running down the street when they were in trouble and helped him out with a bad guy.
Well, we've got a question from the web chat.
Sure.
Demogoblin wants to know if you can say anything about the tabletop Dresden game.
Yes, I can say that I actually, my friend Fred Hicks, who's the owner of Evil Hat, who is producing the game, actually came out to visit me earlier this year. And we got to sit and talk about it. And Fred was like, I had no idea how much work this was going to be, you know, to actually get this game produced the way we wanted to. He's like, we had to produce three other game systems just to grow the company enough to produce this game. and so I think we're planning on looking at a full draft this fall, is what I've heard, with production sometime next year.
Hmm.
But we're going to actually get the full text, and then I'm going to go through and I'm going to write smart aleck comments in the margins as Bob the Skull, and I think I'm planning on writing a short piece of fiction to go along with it, and then the book should be out sometime next year.
Very cool. Very cool. Well, let's just run through the graphic novel that I have in my hands is this collection of Dresden File stories. This was published just this week, as I understand.
Yes, I think so.
Right, and then I'm cheating. I'm looking at your site here. Stormfront number 4 hit stores about 2 weeks ago.
Right.
And the latest published novel in the series is Turncoat, and that came out about 2 months ago.
Yeah, it came out in April, and went to number 1 on the New York Times list.
Well, congratulations on that. Also, Stormfront was nominated for a Hugo Award this year, right?
Yes, it was.
Yeah.
It was one of the graphic novels that was Stormfront wasn't, but Welcome to the Jungle, the first one in the series.
Oh, okay. I'm sorry.
And that was nominated for a Hugo Award. I think it's there to give better boost cred to whoever actually wins it, because it was like my first graphic novel script that I'd ever written. I want to do some more in the future when I've got some more time, but you know, I have no illusions that it was a particularly awesome script, although Ardian's art helped it a lot.
Mm. Of course, if you win, you're going to have to kick poor old Mark Powers to the curb and write some more.
Oh, no. Oh, God. No, I can't do that. No, I've promised my family. I've made sacred oaths that I can only take on so many projects at a time because, you know, there's good dad and bad dad and then insane dad, and nobody wants to live with the insane guy. So I've got to not have too many pots on the fire.
All right. Well, we'll both go back to being good dads as we wrap this up.
Okay.
I know mine are waiting for me because they want me to be in there to watch. I'm a celebrity. Get me out of here because it's only quality TV in the Andelman Mr. Media household.
Right. I think we're off to watch Deadliest Warrior tonight.
Well.
Yeah. I think tonight is Viking versus Ninja. So.
Okay. I think you win.
We have to go see if it's the Viking or the Ninja. We just don't know.
Well, folks, listen. You can find, as I've mentioned, Jim Butcher's latest graphic novel, the collection, The Dresden Files Stormfront, The Gathering Storm, Volume 1, long, long title, but worth the time, in great bookstores everywhere, or you can order it online at MrMedia.com or Amazon.com. And as I mentioned, the latest novel in the series, Turncoat, is also just out. When is the next book, Jim?
The next book will be out next April. It's called Changes.
Inspired by David Bowie, no doubt.
No, yeah, exactly. No, wait, maybe not.
Maybe not. And, of course, if you want to learn more about Jim's universe or keep up on if he's got some personal appearances or some gaming coming up, he can let you know. I think he lets people know when he's going to be gaming. You can check all that out on his personal website, www.jim-butcher.com. And, of course, you can also check out his wife's work at Shannon Butcher,
ShannonKButcher.com.
That's solid, ShannonKButcher.com. Hey, Jim, I feel like I've missed a whole universe, and I'm going to be working to catch up on it in the coming months. I really enjoyed this graphic novel, and it was a pleasure having you on the show. I hope you had a good time. And
hey, thanks for inviting me.
My pleasure. Have a great evening.
You too.
All right. Bye-bye. Bye-bye. So, folks, for more great sci-fi and comics-related interviews, you can surf over to our main website, www.mrmedia.com. That's where you can listen to my earlier conversations with everyone from Milo Ventimiglia and Adrian Pastar of Heroes, to Dark Knight film producer Michael Uslan, as well as interviews with artists and writers such as Dave Gibbons, Kevin Anderson, Gene Colan, Trina Robbins, Peter Cooperberg, and many more. And please think about writing an online review of Mr. Media, casting a vote for Mr. Media, or marking Mr. Media as one of your favorites. Whether you listen on Blog Talk Radio, Pointer Online, MySpace, Facebook, NetVibes, Multiply, Zanga, DigitalJournal.com, Friendster, Orkut, Bebo, Tagged, iGoogle, Yahoo, Podcast, Pickle, Vox, Folio, MediaFly.com, Podfeed.net, Blueberry, Zencast, or Odeo. And subscribe to Mr. Media on iTunes, and you'll never miss a show. Just search Mr. Media Interviews within the podcast section of iTunes and click the free subscribe button. It's that easy. You can also listen with a piece of string and a tin can in many locations. If you've got an idea for a guest, email me directly at bob@andelman.com. That's A-N-D-E-L-M-A-N. You can also follow me on Facebook or on Twitter, www.twitter.com/andelman. Thanks so much for joining us today. Always appreciate when you give a piece of your day or night to spend it with us. Thanks for listening.